This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
You're listening to The Breakfast Grill and I'm Lynn Mark. Today we're taking a look back at some of the biggest conversations we had about the economy, a mainstay on the show. Of course, we constantly checked in with economists about how the Malaysian economy in particular is doing. When Wong Shaoning spoke with Tan Sri Dato' Dr. Lin Siyan, the former deputy governor of Bank Negara Malaysia, about this earlier this year, he highlighted the factors of the economy that are the most concerning to him.
There are 2 points I want to make about the Malaysian economy. The first one is not obvious. In fact, it came as a surprise to me. We learned in economics that a country can only grow on the basis of two things. One, increase in population. The population increase itself drives GDP. Second, investment. So with these two legs, we have always been running on these two legs, population and growth of investment. Let me talk about the first one first. Today, to my surprise, our population, natural rate of population growth is declining. The thing that surprised me is that the fertility rate of females in Malaysia is 1.9. You need 2.1 to sustain the population growth. When I first joined Bank Negara in the 60s, it was 4.5. Today is less than 2. So what happens is, we are running on one leg. People forget that. You are running on one leg. In a sense, we can still run because we have imported unskilled labor. That's not reliable. The second one that is very important is growth of investment. If you look at the Bank Negara numbers, first quarter, zero. No growth. Second quarter, 2.5%. That explains why productivity is so low. So when your two legs are not running, how do you expect the economy to grow? Except by pumping. So the number you mentioned by Bank Negara, 4.5, 4.75, are what I call sugar high numbers, you know. Not sustainable. And if you look at, you disaggregated it and look at the numbers, it is pushed by consumption. You cannot grow consumption faster than the growth of your income. Which means that if you do that, your debt rises.
Which just explains the high household debt, right? Exactly. Of 83% in Malaysia.
And it's not danger area yet, but close to. And so these are not good signs. So I'm one of those that are not optimistic. I think people... Bank, including bank, my whole organization, Bank Negara, and the ministers, everybody say, oh, Malaysia is fundamentally strong. How can you be fundamentally strong if you are running on one leg? And then one leg is tired. You know? Secondly, the economy is not reforming. That's something fundamentally, besides propping it up, there's no fundamental drive. That means there's no productivity growth. And the thing that worries me a lot in this area is, unless you reform that economy and move investment, you'll be like that. One of the key indicators why the economy is weak is as follows. Why are foreign direct investment flows into Malaysia so weak?
Especially compared to some of our ASEAN neighbors,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, why? If your economy is so strong, why is your unemployment rate so high? Especially when you disaggregated the numbers. You look at the unemployment rates of graduates, you look at the number rate of unemployment of our youth, they're not good.
Are you concerned about low wages also? Because that seems to ail us for the last 10 years, right?
There are two reasons for why wages are low. One is, of course, imported unskilled labour dampens the wage rate. We should get rid of them. But the more fundamental problem is we are not engaged in industries that enables the labour market to rise up the ladder, rise up value added. So if you are not producing jobs that are giving you higher and higher value added, how can you expect wages to grow? And so this is reflected in your low productivity. All comes back to productivity. And productivity is driven by two things. One, investment. can't run from it. Secondly, of course, is innovation and creativity. That takes time.
So, Tan Sri, what kind of structural reforms would you like to see?
First, get rid of imported labour. Imported labour is doing us a disservice, and what happens is creating bad habits in Malaysia. Our people are so used to cheap labour, they just become complacent. They never create, they never try to increase productivity, but there will be some exceptions. For example, if husband and wife work, we should allow them to import a maid if our people don't want to work as maids. They must be value added overall, right? For example, the population is aging. No question about it. Who is going to take care of our older people? We might have to import some labour to do that. But I object to, for example, importing labour to maintain cheap labour intensive industries. For example, I used to sit on the board of Top Glove. We produce 45 billion gloves a year. Billion, not million, billion. The packing is done by hand by Bangladeshis. Why? So now they have begun to use robots and things like that. That's a good thing. And the government did the right thing at that time, set up a fund where people can draw at cheap rates to fund their mechanization. We need much more of that. In plantations, the same thing. They say, well, the land is undulated, we need cheap labor to plant. I don't believe that with today's technology, we cannot mechanize our plantations. We have to change. So it's first thing, mindset. Before you can have structural reforms, you must change mindsets.
Throughout the interview with him, his key point was that in order to progress, Malaysia needs to move up the value chain as well as make drastic improvements to our education system in order to foster entrepreneurship and creativity. And of course, when speaking about the economy in 2019, we have to talk about the US-China trade war, which really dominated headlines. There were reports and speculation that Malaysia might benefit from the trade war due to a substitution effect. But Tan Sri Lin disagrees.
Nobody wins in a trade war. And there are two aspects, I think there are two things underlying this trade war which people have to understand. First thing is, China will not be bullied. And that's what Trump is doing. And hence you have that impasse. Second, the trade war is about not trade, but technology. The Americans is using the trade war to disguise their displeasure that China is rising above them in terms of technological development in AI, in robotics.
5G is a big thing.
Exactly. So that is under. So you have, in order to understand the trade war, you have to understand that Malaysia is a small fellow in this game. So we are collateral damage. Unfortunately for us, we cannot benefit from the relocation of American industries from China, outside China. They will not go back to the America. Very little will go back to America. You have to understand the supply chain. So a lot of them will go to countries that can fit the bill. Vietnam fits it perfectly. To some extent, Philippines. Malaysia is too so yesterday.
We also discussed trade deals. If Malaysia is not benefiting from the trade war, could we benefit from trade deals? In Shaoning's conversation with development economist Jomo Kwame Sundaram, she asked him about his opposition to trade deals. Here he explains why, using the TPP and the CPTPP as examples.
As far as the so-called advantages of joining the TPP is concerned, the main advantage would have been better access, slightly better access. Frankly, the so-called gains are very modest, but the slightly better access to the US market in some areas. But the negative implications, particularly, for example, in terms of strengthened property rights, in terms of something called ISDS, Investor-State Dispute Settlement, are so considerable, besides the fact it was actually going to be negative on the trade side, that we really needed to reject the TPP. Now, the CPTPP without access to the US market is even worse. We would have an increase in some exports, undeniably, but a far greater increase of imports. And these imports will be, number one, Japanese cars. Okay, because Australia, Singapore and all that, they don't produce cars. So Japanese cars would come in a big way. And basically, the Malaysian, you can say goodbye to Proton and Perodua. Now, some people who have opposed Proton and Perodua would see this as desirable. But I think it would be disastrous. The second largest source of imports would be accounted for by plastic, including plastic waste. And it's not a coincidence that the three largest sources of import of plastic waste today are Japan, Australia, and Singapore, respectively.
This will be a crucial area for us to monitor in 2020, especially since Malaysia is a party to the RCEP, which is said to be the largest trading bloc in the world. Jomo also highlighted how a breakdown in multilateralism and an uptick in protectionism is not just a threat to trade, but also to sustainable growth and efforts to combat climate change, which he sees as one of the biggest threats we face going forward.
I was working for Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and we propose a global Green New Deal.
At the United Nations, right?
Right. Unfortunately, the global part of it never took off. There was no seriousness, particularly on the part of the rich countries, to have any kind of international solidarity. In fact, we find that there was a certain degree of protectionism all around, especially by the developed countries. This was stemmed partially, but now, as we know, protectionism has become almost fashionable in not only in the rich countries, but also in some developing countries. This, of course, has very important and consequences for the possibility of growth on the previous basis. But I think more importantly, we have not only lost an opportunity to stimulate the world economy and resume growth on a more sustainable basis. Very importantly, I think we have also lost an opportunity to try to address issues involving sustainability, particularly environmental sustainability. And most importantly, I think our proposal was involved questions of how to address global warming. The situation is very, very dire. I don't want to exaggerate, but it is so serious that it's not even funny. And we need to have that kind of international solidarity. But unfortunately, international solidarity has broken down, and the kind of ethno-populism and ethno-nationalism which we see, particularly in the West now, is such that it is very, very unlikely that there will be a resumption of the kind of solidarity or even multilateralism, which is so much needed in order for this situation to be addressed.
When we come back, more on the challenges to the Malaysian economy. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where we're going over some of the most important conversations we've had about the economy this year. One of the biggest news that will shape our economy moving forward is the Pakatan Harapan government's Shared Prosperity Blueprint, meant to be implemented from 2021 to 2030. This framework is meant to increase the incomes of all ethnic groups, but particularly the Bumiputras. Kusu Chuang spoke to our very own Prime Minister, Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, about the objective of this plan.
Well, we notice that the distribution of wealth in this country is not even, and also even, not even fair. For example, between urban and rural, there is a great disparity. We need to make corrections on that. Between state and state, some states are very rich, some states are very poor. That also we have to make correction. We have a problem with the performance of some ethnic groups, for example, the Bumiputra, including the Bumiputra in Sabah, Sarawak. They are rather poor by comparison to the people of other races living elsewhere. All these things have been looked at, and we feel that we need to redistribute wealth in a fair way, because if there is great disparity, then there will be antagonism, and that antagonism may increase over time to the point where it may break out into some violence.
When more details about the plan were revealed, we also had an extended conversation with Nizam Masha, CEO of Institute Masa Depan Malaysia, which created the blueprint with the Ministry of Finance, as well as with Tricia Yeo, research fellow at the Institute of Democracy and Economic Affairs. The Shared Prosperity Plan included more affirmative action for the Bumiputra Group, so Chuang pressed Nizam on whether continuing to pursue affirmative action along racial lines, as opposed to economic lines, is really the right way to go, and questioned them on how effective 50 years of such policies have actually been.
In the context of the shared prosperity, it's basically trying to build the capacity and capabilities of everyone, which include different races, to achieve a more competitive and more, I think, their viability in terms of incorporating themselves in the new economy. And I think, and on that part, we have not seen a lot of achievement. There's still the numbers of professionals, the numbers of jobs in the new areas of growth is still very lacking. So that creates that majority of people just having kind of low income to them. And that is the effect of disparity. There are quite mention of the elements of corruption. I think we acknowledge that as one of the big problem in the shared prosperity. For instance, a lot of these affirmative actions that was provided in the last how many years before has not actually built the competitiveness of the Bumiputra community, and that contributed them to be lacking in their involvement in the economy as a whole. So there are some discussions in the preliminary side of the development of these proposals, looking that almost like more than 50% of the contribution of procurement towards the Bumiputra, but less than 9% of their contribution back to the GDP. So there's a lot of leakages there.
Tricia, if Ideas was in charge of formulating the policy and to address the disparities in society, how would you have done it?
Well, first, I think I just want to address some of the points. I think that while, yes, we talk about these, you know, gross disparities that exist between the communities in Malaysia, I think we also have to recognise that many of these policies over, you know, from the 1970s to present day actually did elevate a large number of Malays out of poverty. We should recognise that. Many Malays went into professions like, you know, engineering and so on. And many of them exist today. If you compare the statistics between now and 30 years ago, you will find that a large Malay professional class has risen out of poverty. And I think one thing you said, Khoo Suchuang, was that this is an opportunity to move away from race-based narratives. And I think the Pakatan Harapan's experience of administering the state of Selangor was an excellent, you know, example that perhaps could have been used by the current government of the day, in which race was rarely used and yet people were accepting of the government because policies were actually being implemented for all, regardless of race. I think I want to also stress what the document itself says, that the Bumiputra income contribution to GDP minus the GLCs was 28% of GDP in 2014, right? That says that if you take out GLCs from the economy, there isn't so much Bumiputra contribution to the GDP. And what this means is that the emphasis should be on SMEs, as the document rightly points out. But while the document looks at trying to, you know, to raise SMEs and to stress upon them as again, the future engine of growth, the document says nothing about GLCs, and our government-linked companies really need to be reformed. The GLCs, you know, form a large percentage of our KLCI and market capitalization in the country today. So one thing that I think Ideas has been promoting is that the GLCs should actually divest, reduce perhaps its market cap to perhaps 10% of the market capitalization. And that means that it allows the private sector, the SMEs, to flourish more. They can get involved and invested into the economy much more.
So how would Ideas address this issue?
We actually have produced a document, and some of the proposals for what we envision shared prosperity to be would be to introduce, number one, a living wage tax credit, which is an introduction of tiered corporate tax incentives to encourage companies to increase the salaries of their employees above the minimum wage. So we recognise that, yeah, perhaps the minimum wage isn't enough. So a living wage, which would be up to 2,500 ringgit per month, may be a lot more palatable. And even then, 2,500 ringgit is actually nothing for urban areas. The second thing that we've proposed is an employee equity scheme where personal and corporate tax incentives would be given to encourage the transfer of shares from company owners to employees. So that when the companies allocate these shares up to about 10,000 ringgit per employee annually, this would be tax-free for the companies as well. And the third thing that has been proposed is actually, you might be surprised that IDIS is the one proposing it, but a capital gains tax. I think this has been mentioned in the past, and many countries do have it, but we've actually proposed a 5% capital gains tax for basically people who are making their profits off share disposals. And the key here, though, is that we are not saying that government should force their companies to increase the wages of their staff. We're not forcing the companies to share their shares to their employees, but these are all provided as incentives. So I think where we're coming from is that we don't see the government's role in ensuring that these shared outcomes will become a reality. What we see government doing is perhaps becoming a nudge agent or a regulator of behavior of the corporate sector.
Of course, wealth distribution is no small feat. So let's close with what Tun Dr. Mahathir had to say when Chuang asked him about the challenges to this.
Affirmative action is one of the things we have tried. It was not a total failure. Quite a number of people benefited from that. But when you give opportunities to people who are unable to manage, they fail. If it is because they don't have the opportunity or the capital, we can make correction. But the ability of the people concerned is not the same. Some of them, their culture-wise, they are really not suitable for going into business, for example.
So how do you solve that problem?
Train them. We know where their weaknesses are. We have to train them in management, so that they will not make too many mistakes.
So in your opinion, it's an educational issue, not a cultural issue or even a...
Yeah, it is an educational issue. It is a cultural issue. It is an educational issue because in the school, we don't train people how to manage things. Now we have to focus on financing and management and things like that so that when they graduate or they leave school, they will know something about how to do business.
You can catch all these conversations and more on bfm.my or on the BFM app. You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.